Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everybody. This is Renee. Welcome back to Renee's Heart to Heart. Thanks for coming by tonight. I hope everybody's ready for a wonderful, relaxing, happy weekend. Happy Friday to those of you that really means something to, those of you who are grinding away at it from Monday through Friday and look so forward to Friday evening. After you retire, Fridays don't mean much anymore. And it's funny that they don't mean anything, but you still look forward to them. Must be one of those human nature things, because I still think, oh my gosh, it's Friday, and it makes me feel all of a sudden a little bit lighthearted, and I realize, what do I care whether it's Friday? Could be any day of the week. I don't have to go to work tomorrow. So funny how you become so trained in things like that. Friday is recap day, and as most of you know, Monday we didn't have a show because there were some technical difficulties with Blog Talk Radio. Tuesday night I had Barry Holive on the show, and we talked about Medicare and Social Security and the subsidizing your Medicare. And I think Barry was very helpful to all of us. He shared with us the rules, if you will, along with the ability to do really what you want to do as long as you understand the ropes. One of the things we talked about were Part A, B, C, and D. And Part A, of course, is the hospital care. And it's Part B is doctor's visits and surgeries and outpatient care. And Part C is when you get another policy to replace the benefits that you get from A and B, and sometimes covers more of them, less of a copay. And Part D is purely prescription coverage. And it was pretty self-explanatory once he sets it out for you. And we talked about whether or not Medicare can carry you through if you need hospice care. I've talked about hospice before, and we talked a little bit about it Tuesday night as well. Hospice doesn't, as a rule, turn away anyone if you are if you've been your prognosis is terminal, and I give them a lot of credit for what they do and all the things that they have thought of, such as they have clergymen on the floors all the time. They have people that come to your home. They have nurses that come and give care to their patients. My daughter-in-law's mother, I'm a little confused evidently, but I remember now, my daughter-in-law's mother has Alzheimer's, and she is in her early 80s, and she is under hospice care. And they come and help her with her baths and make sure her medications are good and even deliver her medications. They are wonderful. And they also offer week-long breaks for my son and his wife, which sometimes is just the nicest thing anybody could ever possibly do for them. So I think hospice is an amazing organization. I mentioned before that I'm a volunteer for it, and that's why. And all the years that I worked at Hippocrates, they helped me so many times. And sometimes it was just for wound care, which can be pretty dramatic when somebody is in the final stages of specific kinds of cancer. And they were just really, really wonderful. So we talked about all that, and then the upside of our conversation with Barry was about his grandson, who was born with Down syndrome and who is a professional fighter. And he did this all for himself. He brought himself to a place where he was accepted into this organization so that he can learn how to fight. And he's had several matches and is doing very well. And it is our hope that eventually we'll have him on the show so that he can share his story with us. So that brings us to Wednesday night. Wednesday night we had Izzy Kalman back. And we talked some more about bullying and some of the other things that that we've talked about with Izzy on many occasions. Izzy is the director of Bullies to Buddies, and he has a wonderful website, and he has many, many options to explain to young people and to their parents and to teachers, if he's invited in, to help them work through these things. I'm going to bring Shelley in. Her number was up, but it didn't tell me she was ready to talk to me. It does now. I'm going to bring her in. Hi, Shell. Shelley?
Hey, me? Yes, I'm in real bad weather, so my antenna's going up and down. You might lose me. Sorry.
Well, that's all right. Well, you came in on my dashboard, but the little blue circle that tells me you're ready to talk didn't come on until just a minute ago, so I thought maybe you might be going through some yucky weather. So we're already up to Wednesday.
Yep, that was great.
And talking, talking about all the things that we talked about with Izzy. And one of the things we brought up, which I had misunderstood, because when Izzy left me the message that night, I thought he said psychiatry didn't think that's a good idea, when in actuality he was explaining to me that the people who are big in the anti-bullying project, they're the ones that don't believe you should bring a victim in with the bully. And I see their point of view. I think we both did. And we understand why, in some cases, a victim doesn't want to be in the same room with somebody who has been really picking on them to that extent. But you and I both have seen it work so many times, we're both still of the belief that it's a good thing to do.
Right. And like I said, and except in extreme situations, it really is very healing for both sides. It puts both of their attitudes in a different perspective, and it can actually be very liberating for both the person that considers themselves the victim and for the person who is angry enough to be the perpetrator. It really kind of does a lot of healing on both sides. And I know that Izzy likes that technique, except in extreme situations. And I think those are the exceptions to the rule anyway. I think most of the time it is helpful.
Well, and one of the other things that he's always made the point with us is that so often the bully feels as though he or she is the victim, because in their mind they may be reacting to something, maybe not hitting it back in the right court. You know, like if you're playing volleyball and the guy spikes it to you and you hit it back to the guy that spiked it to you because he hit it so hard, and that may not be the way it goes. You hit it back and it might land on somebody else's head. So, you know, it doesn't stop them from feeling like they're being picked on too. So sometimes the outlet is really not the right choice, and it kind of goes in a bit of a vicious circle. And I remember the first night he said that to me, I was telling a story, and he said, Renee, why do you call him a bully? And it kind of took me by surprise when he said that. I said, well, because that's the story I'm talking about. It's a bully who's bullying another kid. I read it out of the newspaper. And he said, would it surprise you to know that that maybe he doesn't think he's being a bully, that maybe he thinks he's the victim. And I really had to stop and think about that for a minute. And, of course, I don't think that's true in every case, but I'm sure it's true in some cases. And that in itself is kind of a, I don't know, kind of opens a few other doors when you think about these things, doesn't it?
That's right.
I mean, for me, it was like, oh, my God, yes. And, of course, when you open a door like that, the water gets deeper, for sure. But it's I don't know, there's something that's special about being able to see the side of a story like that and have it take a turn like that. He also asked us specific questions because I mentioned that my granddaughter said she didn't like to go to certain parties. With some of the younger kids, she's 16, and some of her friends from middle school that she's known most of her life, you know, are like 14 and 15. And she says there's too much drama, and she doesn't like to go there. And so Izzy said that very often people enjoy the drama. And, of course, that's true. We really know that. It's just like we've talked about, people don't get as excited about hearing good news as they do. I don't know that they get excited when they hear bad news, but it's certainly more entertaining for them to hear some of the bad news. But we talked about the fact that everybody wants some form of drama. And I really, really mulled that over the last few days with some of the other articles I've read and things like that. And, of course, he's absolutely right. Drama. I mean, I know women or girls that pick a fight with their husband because things seem boring. And they just want their attention. And I would say that that is somebody who is the drama part of life is appealing to them. And like I said, and I still maintain this, many times people conjure up drama because it means attention. And let's face it, we all want a certain amount of attention. We all appreciate having people think about us, even worry about us sometimes, and have their undivided attention, just like when we were children. That doesn't happen too often when you become an adult, I don't think. I think most of the time you are the one that is thinking of other people, especially with other young people. I think young people, if you're the grown-up and they're the young people, they think you've got it all under control and you don't need those things. When the truth is that some of those things never change, no matter how old you get. You still appreciate thinking that somebody's thinking about you and that somebody's worried about you and that somebody certainly cares about you. So I think all those, the things that we talked about were absolutely the truth. I have been composing a letter to send to the school board at the school that I mentioned the other night, and I'm hoping that they'll at least talk with me. I will try to have that done by this over the weekend and see if I can get in the door, see if I can do anything that's going to open some doors for Izzy to start some work here in South Florida, because I think we have a lot of discord in the schools. And again, I think it's mostly middle schools, and I think that it's mostly kids that are still trying to figure out who they are, which all kinds of plays, one thing plays into the other. So I would love to be able to do that and see what we can find out to help. Now, Thursday night, I talked about Time Magazine, and I talked about the fact that there were some very, very interesting articles by some leaders. The two that I quoted are both black, And it made me feel really good to hear them say some of the things that I say myself. So I composed something, and I decided I would read it again tonight because it really sums up what I read in the Time magazine. After reading these articles today in Time magazine, I realized that there are several of us who get it. We get that we must be better leaders with solutions that serve all of mankind, starting with education. I'm not talking about the 3 R's, reading, writing, and arithmetic. That is always at the forefront, and it gets quite a bit of consideration as well as many organizations that supervise its operation. I'm actually talking about playground education, how we teach the very young about sharing and caring. They actually begin better than they end. In the beginning, they're colorblind, for one thing. Second, they don't judge. Third, they do want your attention and they do want your friendship. What happens is us, the very color conscious, the judgmental, and the jealous adults. This, by the way, includes all of us, whether we're white or black or yellow or brown or striped. We plant these seeds every day. And we plant them with our kids. Our leaders, the ones large and in charge, need to create a world that does not have so many levels of lifestyle. That's one of our biggest problems. Jobs that, when done well and with talent, get paid enough to live on. Utilities that do not wipe out the monthly income of our senior citizens. The opportunity to live comfortably, legally. Stop spending enormous amounts of money on the campaign trail. We have all kinds of media and technology today. Don't fly all over the world for nothing. You can talk from the comfort of your office to us in the comfort of our homes. It's safer and nicer for everyone. Fix the vast differential of income between CEOs and the reason they are so successful. Ideas are expensive, I get that. But the execution of the ideas should be paid for as well. If we could make some of these changes, there would be less anger, jealousy, hence less violence. Opportunities that are made available to earn a livable living will curb the theft and the illegal activities. We will never stop everything that's bad, but we can make things much better than they are right now. When controversy is the blue plate special every day, it's what we all consume, and it fills us up with more hatred and less humanity. So let's mourn those lost without reason and celebrate the opportunity to not ever let it happen again. Now, again, I compose that, and it sums up the way I feel about not just the Trayvon Martin case, but all the other things. Last night when I read the article in the Time magazine with all the statistics about black men, I could give some smart aleck answers to that, but do I really know? Does anybody really know why that's the truth? Why the biggest majority of perpetrators and victims are young black men? I think part of it is what I mentioned. Part of it has to do with being able to make a true living by doing something that you can do and love and care about and get immersed in and make a living at it. Not $7 an hour, a living. The kind of living where you can pay your rent and your utilities and drive a decent car and have insurance, don't drive without insurance, and have all the things that you need that are supposed to be a part of the American dream. Today, a young couple, it is impossible today. I don't care if they just graduated from Yale. It is impossible for them to just start out with a brand new job and be able to live. If they're going to Yale, they're used to having a few things, unless they got a scholarship. If they're going to live in the same kind of level that they've been living all in their whole lives, they're going to need help from mom and dad. And that's fine, because mom and dad can afford to help them more than likely. But what about the kid that graduates from a local junior college and thinks that they've learned, gotten more education, and now they can get a good job? Because that's what you see on TV, that's what you read, that's what you hear every single day. And so they make a job, they start a job where they're going to get a salary, and it's going to be $40,000 a year. And they're so excited about that. Well, you and I both know $40,000 a year is nothing. Nothing today. And if you're the only one bringing home a paycheck, you're still in trouble with a house and a car and utilities and insurance and all of the above. Shell, are you back?
Yeah, I'm back. Yeah, having issues, although I'm in clearer weather now, so it should be good.
Okay, well, good. Well, I kind of recapped, and I also reread the article that I wrote last night, and the fact that I had Shelley wasn't on the show last night, for those of you who don't know that. So she didn't hear last night's show, and she doesn't know about the articles that I read in the Time magazine. But one of the things that I wrote in the paper that I wrote is about our leaders helping us to change, first of all, the minimum wage, and taking it from $7-something to $10 seems like a huge jump. But $10 an hour for a 40-hour week is $400, and if you bring home $320, you're lucky, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
So how is $320, say you want to live by yourself and you want to have a one-bedroom, one-bath apartment, and you want to drive, maybe not a brand-new car, but a car that's like 5 or 6 years old, and you got to have insurance on it and everything, you can't afford it. You really can't afford it, because minimally your rent is going to be $600. Then your utilities. Then, depending on where you live, whether you have to, like, if you live out here in the acreage with us, you don't have to pay city water. But you better be prepared to spend minimally $100 a month on keeping your water drinkable or usable.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So it's just not right, and I think it's one of the biggest reasons that we have so much anger and crime, because people can't get by. And then you've got this unbelievable difference between these people and the people that I talked about the other night when I got so upset about how much more a man was making as the CEO of a Fortune 500, another $100 million. And what does somebody have to do for $100 million?
Right.
$100 million, and yet everywhere you look, you have homeless. You have people that can't afford to eat. You have the government buying, handing out food stamps, all this kind of stuff. And yet we have people, CEOs of organizations that are governed by no one. Nobody's overseeing them. Nobody's making sure that they're doing things the way they should be doing them. And they're getting by on over $100 million. Something is very, very wrong. I mean, this is like BC when kings and like before Christ, when kings and everybody, you know, sat in castles and had all the luxuries weren't what they are today, but they didn't live in dirt floored huts, you know, they lived in big castles and had anything and everything that they wanted, while their townspeople lived in huts with dirt floors and died at the age of 20 because they couldn't stand to live anymore, evidently. So,
well,
at any rate,
they died of diseases of squalor and things like that.
Yes.
You know, it's
yes.
Very,
well, that's the truth. Yes, right. So,
yeah, but there's too many inequities. There's too many breaks given to the people that have, so that the people that have just get more and more and more, and everything, all the responsibilities, the financial responsibilities to pay taxes and things like that are being levied on the middle class, and the middle class is really now the lower class. There really is no middle class anymore because the middle class is struggling too much. Middle class people used to be, you know, they weren't wealthy, but they were okay with getting by. That's not even the case anymore. Even the middle class people struggle, and it's not the way it should be. And if there's too much lopsidedness with the way pricing is done, you know, this is probably a very controversial thing to say, I don't care, but inflation is manufactured, it's fake. And a lot of what happens with our monetary system is done deliberately. I believe it's done so that the people that have the wealth maintain the wealth, because if you notice, no matter when there is hardship that's happening, it only affects the middle and lower class. The people that are wealthy actually get wealthier. Has anybody ever noticed that?
Financially speaking, I think there's reasons for that, reasons that are pretty much over my head, but I think there's reasons for that just because of the way our finances work, our money works. So, I mean, if you're very, very wealthy and everybody else has to sell everything that they have to keep themselves afloat and fed and clothes on their back and things like that, then the very wealthy get to buy everything up, and pretty soon they own everything, and you're down to just living with the food that you have left in the cupboard and the shirt on your back. And it's really awful. And I, like I said, instead of standing up there, and one of the articles that I read last night talked about how all of our leaders talk about, Iraq and all these places and them hurting us and have to watch out for all these people that are coming here to hurt us and doing this and spending millions and millions of dollars on you know, monitoring all this instead of worrying about how much crime is happening in our streets from people that don't have any other outlet, don't know what else to do, so they resort to criminal activity, in most cases, to make a living.
That's right.
And that's awful. I mean, that's, you know, and at the end of the day, when we say to them, you know, like we've talked about the Snowden deal, and we talked about the fact that even though for many, many years everybody's talked about the fact that Uncle Sam is watching us and Big Brother's watching us and all those sayings and all the things that we get told all the time, bits and pieces of just enough for us to worry about and gossip about and make up our own stories about. And yet, we know it's pretty much, we know most of that stuff is true. But again, I do want somebody to keep a bit of an eye on that. But in the interim, I also want somebody to be paying attention to their own backyard and what's going on in the backyard instead of just what's going on in other countries.
Right, right. Because the amount of violence within our walls is becoming epidemic.
And yes, absolutely it is.
I'm overly concerned with, like you said, with the people encroaching our borders. But what about the violence that's happening within our borders from our citizens to our citizens? There's not enough being paid to that and viable solutions coming up. You know, and it doesn't mean you incarcerate everybody, What it means is that you freaking put people to work. There is enough that needs to be done. There is enough money in government. It's just being misappropriated. You know, stop running experiments that are nonsensical, that don't benefit everybody, just because some university wants to do this or some science lab or whatever. And, you know, they do these experiments that never benefit anybody, that never come up with any cures. It's just so somebody can get, you know, some sort of a grant, you know, for their college or something like that. And the government doles out hundreds of thousands and millions of dollars a year on these over and over and over again, when that money could be used to provide real jobs for people that, you know, I mean, just look around you. You walk around. Our streets need to be cleaned up. Our buildings need to be repaired. You know, some of these neighborhoods that people live in are in such bad shape. You know, you could put construction workers to work, you know, for 10 years repairing some of the damaged communities we have. And it would just uplift the entire, you know, the entire area where these communities are, you know. So it's like, you know, if you think about it, you could just go on for hours with all these different solutions if the money was spent more wisely and if it was spent in a way to strengthen the United States and not just to keep lining pockets, you know, because somebody got a grant the year before, and you just keep giving grants to the college, and meanwhile you're not even looking at what they're doing with the grant money. Is it benefiting anybody? Is it moving any solutions? Is it creating any social benefit? You know, but people do things out of habit. This grant was created 10 years ago, and the first time it was ever awarded to somebody, it benefited. It benefited society. And now every year they just keep getting the same grant money. I've heard these stories so many times, you know, where people say, well, we keep applying for it, so we keep getting the money, and then they're not even doing anything constructive with it. It's almost like just a vicious cycle. So, you know, like you talked about this before, the people that are in the positions of making decisions have to pay more attention. And you can't just keep going through the motions because their predecessors did or because they have. At some point, you got to stop and look at what you're doing. And it's like, does it make sense anymore? Is it benefiting anybody? Is it the right thing? You know, if it was the right thing 5 years ago, look at it again. Is it still the right thing now? And I think there's a lot of money in government that's just spent in the wrong places.
Well, I mean, remember the night we did the show about elementary schools and how much it costs a parent to send their kid to kindergarten?
Yeah.
And the packages that the teachers want you to buy, and then 3 months later they're asking if you can send in paper towels and if you can send in tissue and if you can send in another box of crayons. And you don't have to, but it would really be nice if you did. And then you hear from the teachers themselves, and I've heard this countless times. And I don't know how many times I've run into teachers in the dollar store buying stuff in the dollar store to keep the supplies up out of their own pocket. So if this is happening, and yet we can spend millions of dollars on worrying about our the terrorism, and yes, I do want somebody to keep an eye on that. Don't, you know, but I also believe that there's a way to do that. Like I said in the report, in the article that I wrote, our technology is awesome today, Shelley. You can do almost anything. If you have the right equipment, I can know what you're doing in your house. I can know what my sister's doing right this minute in Ithaca, New York.
That's right.
I mean, it's like, you know, and for what reasons we're not making sure that these things that everybody thinks are, well, here in Florida, I don't remember what year they reestablished the lottery, but I want to say it was in the 90s. At some point in time in the 90s, they brought the lottery in because our schools were suffering, and it was supposed to help our schools. And there's people that have won millions of dollars in the Florida lottery. And now we have so many different kinds of lottery games that you can play. Has anybody ever seen any kind of accountability for all the money that's brought in for that? minus the prizes that get given out?
Well, if you go on the lottery website, they have signs up, and they recently had a billboard up here, because I used to see it every day. It was on 441 when I was going home, and it said 25 years of contributing to education, and that the total they've contributed to education is billions of dollars. And I'm sitting there going, if you're talking just about Florida schools, how is that possible with the fact that the schools are in such bad financial shape? Billions of dollars? How is that even possible? But that's what they print.
Well, I mean, unless they're talking about 25 years, just 25 years worth of salaries, but isn't there? I don't know. Something not right.
The salaries are paid by the state. So what are they contributing to?
The state pays for each kid that comes into the school, right? And for every day that kid goes to the school, the state pays a certain amount of money on a daily basis for each child that comes into school.
Well,
so,
I'd actually like to go on the lottery. Now that you say that, that's kind of an interesting point. I'd actually like to go on the lottery site, and because they have these, you click on the link, and then it takes you to an article. I'd actually like to read the article of how they explain what they do with that money and what do they actually mean by they contribute to education.
Mm-hmm.
Where does the money actually go to and for what?
Well, I think it is certainly a valid question. And I also think that I have more teachers than this, but right now in the family that lives here in Florida with me, I have a granddaughter who's a teacher, and I have a brother-in-law who teaches part-time because he can't make a living as a teacher. So most of the time he paints homes and apartments and stuff with a company to make more money. But he graduated from college a few years ago to be a teacher, and my granddaughter is a teacher. Neither one of them make enough money to live on as teachers. And both of them talk to me about how much money comes out of their pocket on a monthly basis in regard to making sure that they have all of the things that they need, especially if they're in elementary school, because, of course, in elementary school, books get supplied, but it's the arts and crafts and that kind of stuff that gets so expensive for a teacher.
Right.
And you remember, you're not as old as I am, but I'm pretty sure they were still doing it. You had like a snack time in the morning before lunch. Now kids come to school. The first kids start going in the lunchroom at 10:45, and the kids are in school until 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And there's no snack in the morning. There's no snack in the afternoon. And that was a part of, you know, you got a thing of milk and a cookie or a Fig Newton or something, as I recall. Now they don't get anything like that. But just those little things, you know, I mean, that's not a big deal, but it's just those little things. And then when you know about those billions of dollars, and like I said, I went up to the lottery thing the other day, and I was like, God, the only one I really know what it is Lotto. But there's Moneyball, and there's this, and there's that. There's like six different choices of how to spend your $5 to $20, you know, on a weekly basis. So I don't get that. I just don't get it. And the last paragraph from this Michael Nutter, I'm going to read this real quick. He says, "We are way past the time of just talking. What we really need is action. I know that President Obama cares about these issues, but as powerful as the President of the United States is, he will need a lot of folks to rally with him to work towards solutions. It will require folks to have open minds and open hearts and, more than anything, to be dedicated to change. We can change things, that I know. The question is, are we ready to do it? Are we willing to set ego aside, be vulnerable, and hear things that none of us necessarily want to hear? We have to try right now because our children are dying in the streets every day." This is from Michael Nutter, who is the mayor of Philadelphia. And his article is just a page, but it's he talks just like you and I do about the things that we talk about on the show. So
yeah.
I was very, and then the author poet that I mentioned to you that neither one of us could remember her name. Let me see if I can find her now. She even says the same things, and she talks about it just totally honestly. You know, this
mm-hmm.
is wrong. We have to do something about this because this isn't working the way that we're doing it right now. We have to make the changes. And, of course, she puts a lot of emphasis on the fact that much of our crime and our death is generated by these young black men. But I swear it's because they don't know what else to do. You know, they really don't know what else to do. And I don't think that's a viable excuse, but I do think it's a reason. And big difference between a reason and an excuse, I think.
Right.
But, of course, I can't find her now. This is just a little, oh, here she is. Maya Angelou.
She,
and of course, she is a big advocate of the Martin Luther King I Have a Dream speech.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, and does it seem even a little bit right that that was 50 years ago?
Yeah. Unbelievable,
isn't that
right?
Something? 50 years
wow.
ago.
Wow.
And she writes, she's from North Carolina, but she says, a number of people think that only blacks were hurt, that African Americans were hurt by this decision, but that's not true. All you have to do is look at the protesters. They were white and black, Spanish-speaking and Asian. What is really injured, bruised, if you will, is the psyche of our nation's population. We are all harmed. We are all belittled, and we give to the rest of the world more ammunition to sneer at us. It really makes me see how far we have to go that one man armed with a gun can actually profile a young man because he is black and end up shooting him dead. It is so painful.
Wow.
And she's, I mean, you know, how right can you be? How right can you be?
Yep.
You know?
So,
on another note here, I also wanted to bring up to everybody that this was in the news today. The Castro, the man that kidnapped the three women, he Ariel Castro. Won't get the death penalty for kidnapping and aggravated murder charges. Cleveland, the man accused of abducting and raping three women and holding them captive for years, appeared in a Cleveland court on Friday and accepted a plea deal, allowing him to avoid the death penalty. This is from the Associated Press. As a part of the deal, Ariel Castro will be sentenced to life. Now, how ludicrous is this? Listen to this, because this is, like, stupid to me. As a part of the deal, Ariel Castro will be sentenced to life plus 1,000 years in prison and will not be eligible for parole, according to CNN. He pleaded guilty to 937 charges. Asked if he understood he would never be released from prison, Castro said, "I do understand that, Your Honor." He added, "I knew I was pretty much going to get the book thrown at me." Castro was far more interactive than in previous court appearances, when he mostly kept his head down and eyes closed, the Associated Press said. He said pornography addiction and a sexual problem have taken a toll on his mind. He also said, excuse me, he was sexually abused as a child. According to the Associated Press, the deal comes more than a month after a statement issued on behalf of the three women who said they were hopeful for just a prompt resolution and had great faith in the prosecutor's office and the court. Castro's lawyers have said for weeks that they would consider an agreement under which the former Cleveland school bus driver would plead guilty to some charges in return for his life. Castro, 53, had been charged with 977 counts, including kidnapping and repeated rape. He had also been charged with murder under a fetal homicide law for allegedly forcing one of the women to miscarry. The murder charge carried the death penalty. Gina DeJesus, 23, Michelle Knight, 32, and Amanda Berry, 27, were freed from Castro's home in a rundown area of Cleveland on May 6th. Also freed was a six-year-old girl who, according to DNA evidence, was fathered by Castro with Berry during her captivity. According to the Associated Press, a statement was released Friday by a law firm representing the women. It says they are satisfied by the resolution and looking forward to the end of the legal end of the case. The women had been bound for periods of time in chains or ropes and endured starvation, beatings, and sexual assaults. According to court documents and a police report, none of Castro's family or the victims attended the hearing. There was no immediate comment from the victims. Avoiding trial spares them from having to testify. First of all, there's no such thing as 1,000 years in jail. That's number one. And the fact that that is legal jargon just kind of annoys me.
I know.
He should not be able to sit in a jail and wither away with food and a pillow and a cot every day after the way he abused those three women. He just shouldn't be. It's not. And I, you know me, I'm not vindictive. I'm just not. But this, for me, this is, well, I don't know. We also talk about mental illness, and it sounds to me like he's nutty as a fruitcake. But something about this just doesn't seem fair to me. Does it to you?
Well, I mean, the whole thing is that, you know, the whole thing with two wrongs don't make a right type of thing. I mean, if we do to him what he did to those women, then how are we any better? You know, I mean, there really is no justice. There's no such thing as an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth justice. We just don't do that. If somebody does something that horrific and they're not going to be, the worst thing we can do is put somebody to death. If we don't put them to death, then we just incarcerate them for the rest of their lives. I mean, but we don't torture or mistreat people in our prisons, and, you know, that would be inhumane.
Well, I'm not looking to have him tortured. I think
I know what you're saying.
I think what he meets after he passes will be torturous. But I just feel like the political legalities of this. Is it supposed to make everybody feel like they really, you know, they really got even with this guy by giving him 1,000 years? There's no such thing as that.
Yeah, well, they did that so that there'd be no chance of parole. You know, you give somebody life, and you know, you give them a life sentence, and then, you know, 20 years into a life sentence, and then they can try to get parole. I guess they do that so that it just kind of, like, takes that off the plate, you know. I don't know.
I see.
I don't know why our laws can't just say life without parole. And when you give somebody life without parole, it actually means life without parole. Why can't you just say that? So it's almost like they play games, you know, and I think
yes.
That's what you're reacting
yes.
to.
Yes, that's what I don't like.
You know, because
you want to turn around and you want to tell a 16-year-old to not be ridiculous and not do a 16-year-old says, what's the big deal? And you look at them and say, well, because this is what you did, blah, 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 blah. And then we do this. It's like a contradiction in terms, Shell. It's like you're saying, say what you mean and mean what you say. right?
Yeah, exactly.
Great
right.
line. Right. Great line. I love it. Yeah. But I don't see it ever.
No, because how many times has somebody gotten a life sentence or something like that, and then, you know, so many years into it, they're up to, how do you get parole on a life sentence? I've never understood that, ever.
Me either. I don't understand it. And it works the other way, too. I mean, you know, I think there's a lot of people in jail that shouldn't be in jail as well. A lot of people in prison that shouldn't be in prison. There doesn't seem to be any differential between accidents and murder, number
right.
one.
Right.
There doesn't seem to be any differential between, like we talked the week we talked about mental illness, somebody who does something that's truly insane and they get put in prison versus being put someplace where they may be able to get some help and may be able to lead a normal life at some point in time. They don't get that opportunity. I don't know. Right. There's just so many things for me. The word fair means a lot to me.
I know.
And
with our judicial system, I guess the two biggest problems, you know, this is something we talk a lot about on the show, is that number one, they have too many cookie cutter solutions, you know. So it's like you said, you know, here you have three different people committing very, very different crimes for different reasons. You know, one of them was attacked and defended himself and killed somebody in the throes of defending himself. Somebody else went out to rob somebody, and in the act of crime, you know, killed the person. And then you have somebody else that just flipped out because they're freaking nuts and, you know, thought this person was an alien or something and shot him. I mean, you hear these stories and shot him. You know,
mm-hmm.
you have three complete,
mm-hmm.
they all killed somebody, three totally different situations, and yet they're all going to get, like, the same sentence. It's ridiculous. They're all going to get thrown mm-hmm. in the same jail, you know, and in a cell next to each other. You know, so that's one thing that doesn't make any sense, you know. And then the fact that if you've got a good enough attorney, you know, where money comes into it again, okay,
yeah.
the wealthier you are, the more justice you get.
Mm-hmm.
But it insults me when these plea bargains come down where you get people that really commit horrific crimes and get basically a slap on the wrist because they have the money to have attorneys who just negotiate and as far as I'm concerned, in a very insulting way, a very unfair way to the victim, all right? And then you have other people that commit really pretty minor crimes just because they were in a bad place or had, you know, whatever. But it was more a crime of stupidity than a crime because they were a bad person. But because they don't have the money to get good representation, they don't get a good plea bargain, and they're sitting in jail for 10 years. It's ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
And you see this every day, you know?
Yeah. And read about it all the time. Absolutely. How about the women that are sitting in jail because they cheated welfare because they couldn't feed their kids? Should they have had so many babies? No, they shouldn't have. So why didn't somebody step in when they see, you know, I mean, there's stories abound. The woman, I can't think of her name, I read about her one night on the show the week we did the mental illness, the one that kept, her kids kept dying, and she had Munchausers by proxy and all this kind of stuff. But nobody stepped in and said, okay, we have to, you know, do something so that she can't give birth anymore, and we have to do this, we have to. Nobody took care of the problem. They just let all these babies keep getting killed, and didn't do anything to her. Didn't do anything to her for the longest time. So it's almost like, I don't know, it's like we don't think things through. We decide this is what the law says, so there's no flexibility with any of it. And it's scary.
It reminds me of the time I told you, this is medical, but a lot of our government operates the same way as the medical establishment does right now. It's the doctor's offices are basically controlled by the insurance companies, which are controlled by the pharmaceutical companies. They set the agendas. So if you go in there and you have a particular ailment, they have a certain protocol they have to follow. All right, whether it really matches your particular situation or not, this is the protocol we have to follow. I had had a, if you remember when I had had that, I had, what was it, shingles on my chest, mm-hmm. but I didn't know it was shingles. I didn't know what it was. I was just a mess, and I was in so much pain. And I went to the doctor, and I don't go to medical doctors. This is one of the reasons why I stopped going to medical doctors, but I was just in so much pain. I just wanted a diagnosis because I didn't know what I was dealing with. And this doctor takes a look at me, and I'm red. I just have these red sores from my waistline up to my collarbone, and I'm in excruciating pain. And he wants to send me for a mammogram. And I looked at him, and I was like, I said, are you looking at my skin? I said, do you think I could survive a mammogram? I said, what in the world are you sending me for a mammogram for? I said, I have a rash on my entire chest. He said, well, I have to rule out breast cancer. I said, well, first of all, a mammogram doesn't diagnose breast cancer. It can actually cause it. I mean, it's like I'm talking to this doctor, and he goes, well, I don't know what to tell you. He says, that's the only thing I know what to do. That's what the insurance papers say I have to do. I said, you don't think maybe you should take a skin graft to figure out what this stuff is, or maybe a blood test or something? I can't do that yet. I have to do the mammogram first, because that's what the chart says. So here's this medical doctor who went through many, many years of school, and yet he has no independent thought at all. He has to follow a process on it, and he's not the only doctor I've seen that do that kind of stuff. Now, there are, in all fairness, there are some wonderful forward-thinking doctors out there who get the holistic nature of the body, and even though they're medical doctors, they understand more, and they will make more of a they'll think through something. And just because the insurance person says they have to do this or whatever, I've been fortunate enough to meet doctors like that that are very, very, in almost intuitive, you know, for lack of a better word. And they'll say, okay, yeah, well, I'm supposed to do this, but you know what? Obviously, that's not what you have. Let me do a blood test, and boom, and then they find out what's wrong. But unfortunately, most of the doctors do not independently think for themselves. They're told what to do by other businesses, insurances, or pharmaceutical companies, and that's it. A pharmaceutical company comes in and says, when you get somebody with this particular ailment, you got to give them this pill, so the doctor starts writing out prescriptions. You know, there's no independent thought. And unfortunately, a lot of our legal system is the same way. A lot of the other government agencies are the same way, where everybody's just following a pattern, no independent thought. And this is going back to the comment I made before that it's almost like if at one time it was appropriate to do things this particular way, at some point, as we move forward, technology changes, the way information changes, you know, updates, the way people interact with each other changes. Well, you know what? Some of these processes and procedures have to change along with it, and they don't. So something that might have been completely appropriate 10 years ago, in many cases, isn't appropriate anymore. But they still keep doing it the same way.
I know. Well, you know, it's like the court system. It's like everything. It's I don't know. I think it goes back to what we've talked about before when you read any book. We talked about reading the Bible, and you read the Bible, and you give your interpretation of what you read in the Bible. And I think it's the same with medical journals and medical information. I'll tell you, right now, the stuff that's going on with my son Mike and with my husband Spike is very scary, to say the least, stressful, because you want to put your belief in the person that's supposed to know what they're doing. But when you can say to them, what about this, and they look at you like, oh, yeah, well, we'll do it, like shatters your core. You know, you're thinking to yourself, holy shit, you're not waiting for me to figure out how to do this, are you? I'm a 10th grade dropout, for God's sakes. You know, so it's scary. It is scary.
Yep.
And it seems to be all around us, all around us. We're out of time, though. Michelle, I want to thank you tonight. I hope you're in a safe place now. Are you home yet?
Yep. I'm
okay,
right around
good.
The corner.
Okay. Well, thank you, my darling, and to everybody out there, I want to say from my heart to yours, good night and God bless. Night, Shell.
Good night, Rena. I'll see you in the morning.
All right, sweetheart. 9 o'clock.
You got it.
Okay. Bye-bye.
All right. Good night.